The coronavirus is a global health problem that requires global action, not finger-pointing.
I think this is a moment of dangerous friction and mutual recrimination that frankly needs to stop.
And Russia is at it again, spreading false information, this time about the coronavirus.
That this is something that was created in a U.S. lab.
And what's going on with the global economy? Well, pretty simple.
To try to slow the growth of the virus, what needs to happen is people need to stop going out. And when people go out, a lot of what they do is they consume.
Comparing how the U.S. and Europe try to stave off an economic freefall. Also, a lab in Singapore closing in on a test for the coronavirus. It can tell not just if you're sick, but if you've ever had COVID-19. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. We've been waiting a long time to say this. There's good news today about the coronavirus. China has reported no new locally transmitted cases, only new infections that originated outside China. A ray of hope for the country with the greatest number of cases in the world. Residents of Wuhan shouted and cheered from their balconies and rooftops today. The news of no new infections marks a milestone, further evidence that the spread of the virus can be halted. Winnie Yip is a professor at Harvard School of Public Health.
Yes, it is good news, and I think that the data are reliable. About 2 weeks ago, the World Health Organization led a delegation of international experts and spent about 2 weeks in China. And one of the conclusions is that the data that China have been reporting are reliable. So I'm inclined to believe that the zero new case is reliable data.
We're hearing about new cases in China outside of Hubei province. What accounts for that?
They are all returns from other countries, especially with what is happening in the U.S. and Europe. There is an influx of people returning to China. So the Chinese government is actually being very cautious. Everyone, irrespective of nationals or visitors, they have to go through a 14 days of quarantine in designated hotels or certain sections of hospitals. And interestingly, people actually have to pay for the hotel. I thought that's a smart strategy to provide disincentive for people to return at this time.
So we're looking at a lot of sources for the death rate in Wuhan, China, the epicenter of the outbreak. The official death rate for Wuhan is given as 4%, but the death rate in China outside of Hubei province, where Wuhan is well below 1% of known cases. Why is that?
Well, first of all, in Wuhan, the cases are more severe because in the beginning, when China was unprepared, remember there were, I would say, a few weeks, Wuhan was dealing with huge increases in number of cases with limited number of resources. So there are huge differences between Wuhan and the rest of China. And the number of cases in other parts of China is definitely different. And by then, China is also much more prepared.
I mean, there has been concern all along of a second wave of transmission. Could we be celebrating too soon for China?
I think that China is still in a period of observation. And if you look at Chinese policy, even though they are encouraging people to return to work gradually, the whole country is still, I would say, use the word under vigilance. They separate the country into three categories of risk. And there are different policy, different monitoring, different detection system that is being put in place. So we still need to watch and be careful to avoid a second peak.
And what do any of these data tell us about what we might experience here in the United States?
I think that as many other epidemiologist experts in the U.S. have said, the United States might be, at least for some parts of the country, might be reaching a situation that is similar to the northern parts of Italy in a few weeks' time. And is it going to be like China? I can't tell.
Winnie Yip, professor of the practice of international health policy and economics at the Harvard School of Public Health. Thank you for being with us again.
Thank you.
As China gets a handle on the outbreak, the blame game between the U.S. and China gets sharper. Here's President Trump earlier today talking about the spread.
And if people would have known about it, it could have been stopped in place. It could have been stopped right where it came from, China.
Susan Rice thinks that sort of rhetoric is increasingly dangerous. Rice was a national security advisor under President Obama and also his ambassador to the United Nations. Rice says this is a global fight.
Well, Marco, the reality is that a pandemic, by definition, is a global phenomenon. And it, as we have seen, can arise in any one far corner of the world and spread to another. And putting up walls, halting commerce, halting travel, can potentially slow the spread. But as we're seeing here in the United States, as the president brags about his brilliance in stopping flights from China, it hasn't, in fact, prevented the widespread outbreak here in the United States. And so because it is a global phenomenon, it ultimately is going to require global action to tamp it down.
Even the EU, though, which we thought was a unified body, has retreated into its own kind of traditional nation states. What alternatives do you see right now? Because ultimately, in a crisis with limited resources, isn't each nation's government responsible for protecting only its people?
Yes, of course it is. But the reality is that while we might focus internally in the short term, unless we are able to cooperate globally in the medium to long term, we may shut it down in China or shut it down, you know, in South Korea. But if it, you know, springs up in Africa or springs up in India, it's just going to start another global wave.
You are UN ambassador. Isn't that where this kind of sharing should be taking place right now?
It's certainly one venue where it might be taking place. It's, you know, remarkable to me that in contrast to 2014, when we were dealing with the Ebola epidemic, which obviously was a different sort of a disease, but one that had the world quite rightly scared and cost tens of lives in West Africa, we used the United Nations under President Obama. We convened a summit with the UN Secretary General at the United Nations and brought countries together to spur their collective response. It was a collective action. In the past, the United Nations Security Council has convened around disease threats, including the HIV/AIDS threat back in 2000. So it's not unheard of or unprecedented for that to happen. And yet, when you have a leadership in Washington and in the White House that seems to disdain collective action, even disparage cooperation with our allies, that seems to be the last thing that would occur to them is to use institutions like the United Nations or to draw on the capacity of the World Health Organization, which has its failings, but in this case has seemingly well outperformed the United States government in its ability to help countries respond.
So the two big players on the global scene right now, the U.S. and China, are sounding increasingly hostile towards one another, and not a good thing to happen in the middle of this pandemic. Here's President Trump at yesterday's press conference responding to a reporter's question about who he thinks was to blame for this crisis.
I know who, where it came from. I don't know if you'd say China's to blame. Certainly we didn't get an early run on it. It would have been helpful if we knew about it earlier. But it comes from China, and it's not a question about that. Nobody's questioning that.
Ambassador Rice, do you think Beijing and Washington are experiencing some kind of seismic change here, or do the two governments need each other too much for that to happen?
Well, I think this is a moment of dangerous friction and mutual recrimination that frankly needs to stop. You know, for the president of the United States and those around him to race bait and brand this a Chinese virus or a Wuhan flu or other offensive terms like that is completely inappropriate and unhelpful and unacceptable. It is the case that the virus originated in China. It's also the case that the 2009 H1N1 flu virus, which was extremely deadly globally, originated in North America, as did, I understand, the so-called Spanish flu back in 1918. So there's no advantage in recrimination about where it began. The issue is how do we deal with it? And we have reasons to be critical with how China dealt with it in the early stages, no doubt. But people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. The administration's response to the coronavirus in this country, its delay, its denial, its deception, and now its utter incompetence to deal with critical things like testing, like getting medical supplies, personal protective equipment, ventilators, and the like urgently out to those hospitals that need them. We all need to focus on the imperative of dealing with this crisis, the health crisis and the economic crisis, and realize that over the long run, we're not going to deal with either in isolation.
So what happens? What are the risks if this blame game continues? Like economically, what are the repercussions, do you think?
Well, for better or for worse, our two economies are the largest in the world. They're deeply intertwined. Our supply chains are intertwined. Our technologies are intertwined. And as much as some on both sides may have a fantasy of decoupling our economies, I don't believe that that's feasible. It's certainly not desirable because at the end of the day, that will leave us in competition for smaller slices of a global pie, and each of us will be poorer as a result. So we've got to get through this crisis. We've got to minimize the vitriol and the hostile rhetoric on both sides. You know, China is also taking advantage of this moment while the United States is flailing and turning inward and showing absolutely no global leadership. Even though President Trump is the leader this year of the G7, he's not doing any of the things that we've done in the past. You know, President Bush, President Obama convened the G20 in 2007 and 2008 and 2009 to deal with the global economic crisis. We have led consistently in the past, and now we have a president who believes it's every man, every country for himself, and you know that may be politically appealing, but it's practically deadly, and it won't succeed. So we need to get back to the business of recognizing that these solutions, at the end of the day, both economically and from a global health perspective, are going to require countries to work together.
Finally, Ambassador, President Trump is calling himself a wartime president. Trump says a lot of things, but using the label wartime president, why does that matter?
I'm not particularly interested in how he wants to market himself. I'm interested in whether he's going to finally step up and lead decisively, dispassionately, responsibly, credibly, and get to the American people the medical and economic relief that we need to get through this crisis together.
Ambassador Susan Rice, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Marco.
Susan Rice was a national security advisor under President Obama and also the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. All right, let's pull back from this news for a bit and listen to the piano of Roberto Fonseca. A brilliant musician from Cuba with roots in mambo, Fonseca's talents and musical mind have also taken him deep into Latin jazz territory. Now, because of this pandemic, Fonseca's public performances, like most artists, have been put on pause. But he and his trio showed up at Joe's Pub in New York anyway, for a gig. No one in the room. He cued the applause where it was supposed to be.
Applause.
And then went on to explain why he was on stage without an audience. We're in a difficult situation now, he said, but we continue to make music because we do not want to lose hope. This is why, said Fonseca, we are calling this the Hope Concert. This special concert, he said, is for all of you at home watching us. Music never stops. It's one of the best cures for human beings. Here's some more proof of that from Roberto Fonseca's self-isolated performance. Roberto Fonseca and his trio at Joe's Pub in New York. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Countries in Central America are reporting relatively few cases of the coronavirus. Still, they're in on the fight. El Salvador's president, for example, closed the country's borders more than a week ago to try and contain the virus. But as The World's Jorge Valencia reports, many are concerned these efforts could lead to human rights violations.
President Nayib Bukele of El Salvador is a media-savvy leader, regularly communicating with citizens via Twitter. This week, he gave an urgent yet calm address on national TV.
Buenas noches a todo el pueblo salvadoreño que nos está viendo a través de la cadena.
Bukele wore a crisp white button-down and spoke with the authority that a public health official would. At the time he spoke, El Salvador had no reported cases.
Pero eso no exime de que haya virus que no hayamos detectado.
But that doesn't rule out the possibility that there are cases we simply don't know about, Bukele said.
La diferencia entre Latinoamérica y Europa son los días.
The difference between Latin America and Europe, Bukele adds, is just a few days. The presidents in neighboring Guatemala and Honduras have similarly been assertive in televised addresses.
Yo soy el presidente y doy la cara.
I'm the president and I'll take responsibility, said Guatemala's Alejandro Giammattei. He has blocked all international flights, including planes carrying Guatemalans deported from the U.S. Meanwhile, in Honduras, President Juan Orlando Hernández says the government will help businesses during what will likely be an economic crash.
Estamos listos para implementar la primera fase.
Public health workers worldwide agree on the urgency of the pandemic. But human rights observers say they're becoming increasingly concerned with how some political leaders in Central America might use their emergency powers.
Es una herramienta que podría fácilmente ser utilizada para abusos y arbitrariedades.
They're tools that could be used arbitrarily and abused, says Celia Madrano of the human rights organization Cristosal. She says this is particularly problematic in El Salvador, where Congress approved a temporary suspension of constitutional rights.
Ahorita puede activar fuerzas militares para detener, suspender una reunión.
This means President Bukele can now use military force to break up large gatherings, Medrano says. Bukele has banned groups of more than 75 people. He has ordered public transportation to a halt, and he has instructed employers to send workers 60 and older home with paid leave.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that the public health system in El Salvador is pretty weak.
Jeff Thale is president of the Washington Office on Latin America, an NGO. El Salvador got out of civil war 3 decades ago, a war in which the military frequently violated human rights. So observers were concerned when, just 2 months ago, the current president threatened to use military force if lawmakers in Congress didn't approve a loan he was requesting.
It's clear that this president has been, to be charitable, has been tempted by autocratic tendencies. And that's, in a country with this kind of history, that's a real concern.
For now, the public is not openly protesting the measures implemented by Bukele in El Salvador or his neighboring counterparts. Juan José Hurtado heads Asociación Popnoj, a nonprofit in Guatemala City. He says he had already sent his staff home even before Guatemala's president ordered it.
No, personally, I don't like this government, but I think at this moment it is necessary.
The extraordinary measures taken in parts of Central America are temporary. In El Salvador, they were approved through tomorrow. In Guatemala, they were approved through the weekend. But they are likely to be extended. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
The concern about government overreach in the age of a pandemic goes way beyond Central America. We have that story at theworld.org. Russia has officially reported about 150 cases and just one death from the coronavirus outbreak. President Vladimir Putin says things are under control there. Still, Putin reportedly has around-the-clock surveillance to make sure he does not catch the disease. Moscow is also stirring the pot, making an already anxious world a little more anxious. Nina Jankowicz studies disinformation, technology, and Russia. She says this new disinformation campaign looks a lot like other ones that have come from Russia over the past decade.
Russia's information warfare strategy is to seize on pre-existing fissures and worries in societies and amplify distrust in our institutions. And that's exactly what they're doing with regard to coronavirus. We've seen allegations that this is something that was created in a U.S. lab. We see reports that, you know, China and other countries are doing a better job containing it than the United States. Again, all seizing on people's fear about what's going to happen with their loved ones and also their distrust in institutions and how they're handling this crisis.
So when people outside Russia start mistrusting their own governments and institutions, how does that help Putin?
Well, in a couple of ways. First, it gives him a domestic message to send at home, you know, especially in regard to this change in the Constitution that's allowing him to serve up to 16 more years in power. He can say, aren't you glad that you know what's coming? You have a stable system on which to rely. But it also gives him a seat at the global negotiating table. When we in the West are busy fighting crises in our own domestic arenas, we're paying a lot less attention to the stuff that Russia is doing on the global scale, whether that's adventurism in eastern Ukraine or propping up Assad in Syria.
So the COVID-19 cases being reported in Russia, those numbers are pretty low. How likely is it that Russian officials are not honest about the numbers?
Well, I think they have a track record of not necessarily being honest about issues like this. I mean, you can go back to Chernobyl for a very famous example, but they've misled their public on a number of other government responses over the past several years. So I don't think we have reason to necessarily trust them. And certainly, you know, Russia had a pretty porous border with China for a long time. Russia has lots of international travel coming in and out of it. I think we're likely to see cases spreading there just like we are across the rest of the world.
But their scientists know what science is. I mean, why hide the real figure? Because everything we're hearing from the WHO, the CDC, the experts is that actual data is critical to fighting this thing.
I think, as we've seen with a few other nations, I think including the United States, there is some effort to save face among governments. They want to continue to prop up the markets to whatever extent they can. They don't want their societies to panic. And we've seen the same thing in Russia. The reports that I've seen coming out of Russia from friends who are there are that, you know, Russians are going about their normal business and actually wondering if the rest of the world is overreacting.
So with people inadvertently sharing misinformation or disinformation from other places about coronavirus online, I'm wondering if you have any strategies or suggestions to get people either not to do that or how the rest of us can, you know, learn to find accurate sources of information.
The most important thing is to trust the experts here, not, you know, your grandma with folk remedies, right? But people from the CDC, the WHO, the NHS in Britain, these are the people who are studying the virus that know how to fight it, basically. We need to be very careful that we're not sharing information from strange sources of information, and we need to be careful that we are verifying the information that we do get, and that goes for media outlets as well. There have been text messages circulating, for instance, about different government shutdowns and lockdowns. If you don't hear that information from a government official, and preferably from a healthcare official, not someone who is a politician or a political appointee, I would take it with a grain of salt at this time, because there are, unfortunately, folks who are trying to score political points through this crisis, and that's really unfortunate. And I think, you know, you narrowed in on something that's really important, and it's not just that groups like Russia are sharing dis and misinformation related to the coronavirus. There are a lot of folks domestically who are doing that as well. This is just the perfect nexus of fear and distrust for purveyors of disinformation to manipulate, and there are plenty of folks within our own country who are willing to do that as well.
Nina Jankowicz is a disinformation expert at the Wilson Center. Nina, thanks very much for the update on Russia and for your advice. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
News headlines coming up next. You're listening to The World. The coronavirus has shut down museums across the globe. Art is now going online, along with a new game. Museum enthusiasts have just 60 seconds to play curator.
Hello, fellow isolationists. I've got 1 minute to tell you all about the Fiji mermaid in a tank top for reasons. So, the Fiji mermaid is actually not just one thing, it's a whole collection of things. That's
finding fun and beauty in anxious times. That's coming up on The World. As you've been hearing today, Italy has passed a grim milestone. More than 3,400 people there have died from the coronavirus. That's more than any other country, including China. In the U.S., we also reached a sobering mark today, 10,000 cases, according to the CDC. We know the coronavirus is very contagious. We know it can kill you, especially if you're older or if you've got pre-existing health conditions. And one question that's hovering over the coronavirus pandemic is this: just how lethal is this thing? As health experts try to track the global outbreak of COVID-19, the answer to that question remains a big medical mystery. But as the world's Patrick Nguyen reports, a medical lab in Singapore may be very close to an answer.
Maybe you've heard that the new coronavirus is killing roughly 3.5% of everyone who gets it. Scary, right? Well, here's some good news. That's way too high, according to Lin Fa Wang. He's a doctor based in Singapore, and he is one of the world's top experts in emerging diseases.
3 to 3.5%, I think, is an overestimate.
It's an overestimate, he says, because for now, we don't know how many people get the virus and just get over it. Most people who get tested are already in bad shape. Coughing, fever, sometimes pneumonia-like symptoms.
But if you recover within a day, most people say, don't worry, I'm healthy, right?
Right. Some infected people, they just get a tickle in their throat for a day. They don't get tested, and it goes away. The test that's out there now, it only tells you if your body is currently fighting the virus. But Wang and his team just had a breakthrough, inventing a test that can tell you if you got it, beat it, and already flushed it out of your body. How does it work? Well, they developed a protein that tricks your body into thinking COVID-19 has invaded your bloodstream.
So that protein will mimic the virus, but it's not a virus.
Yeah, it's not the virus, but if you had the virus before, your body will say, ah, seen this before, and go to war. It'll send out antibodies, these things that stick to virus molecules and help to destroy them. Wang's test can determine if your body and its antibodies have fought that war before. And it should work way after you recover. A similar test for SARS still shows if you had it 17 years ago.
So that just gives you an indication how long that lasts, yeah.
This all sounds great. How long would it take to mass produce this test? Years? Months? Sooner?
We're looking at weeks.
Dr. Wang says his lab, which is jointly run by Duke University and the National University of Singapore, is already talking to a company that he hopes can churn out up to 1 million of these tests. And it can't come soon enough, because this could be a vital tool for countries on the early end of a pandemic wave, such as the United States. It makes officials into better disease detectives, figuring out how it's spreading, who spread it where, all of which affects your containment strategy. In Singapore, it's already cracked a case.
Singapore confirmed 9 new cases of COVID-19 today, 6 of which are linked to the cluster from the Grace Assembly of God Church.
That was last month. Officials were baffled. How did this one church get hit so hard with the virus? The test revealed that someone from Wuhan, China, gave it to a Singaporean couple, and they had mild symptoms, never got tested for COVID-19. In fact, they felt good enough to go to a Chinese New Year's party, and that's where they gave it to a guy who then brought it to his church. So this test, it really works. Wang is now sending samples out to fellow scientists around the world, Australia, the UK, the US too, and he thinks it could really help the US if the government decides to use it.
Countries at the beginning of the curve, you know, it's always good to learn how to contain, how to mitigate.
So how about that big question? How lethal is COVID-19? Wang thinks the test will answer that soon, once it's applied on a large scale. But for now, he does have a prediction. By the time this pandemic is over, a lot of people will have gotten COVID-19. I bring up H1N1, swine flu, which infected 1/5 of the human race. Will it be that high?
No, it'll be higher than H1N1.
Yep, and higher still if the world doesn't act fast.
For COVID-19, if we don't do any intervention, we don't do containment, if we don't have a vaccine, then the modeling says that number is not 1/5, it's 2/3.
2/3 of the human race. And that's why knowing the lethality of the virus is so important, because, God forbid, if 2/3 of us get it, that's 5 billion people, even a very tiny fatality rate is enough to kill millions of people. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
The coronavirus outbreak has also quickly become a worldwide economic problem. European governments are scrambling to prop up sinking economies. Italy is suspending mortgage payments. The UK, France, and Germany are offering bank loans to save businesses. Matthew Slaughter is following all of this. He's the dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. I asked him how U.S. solutions compare with the rest of the world's and what Washington is focused on.
Right now, they're focused on workers and their families to ensure the loss of income that's arising from furloughs and unpaid leave and outright layoffs is offset so that these families can keep buying their groceries, can keep paying rent, paying mortgages, to help prevent the damage that's already arising from the COVID-19 from becoming worse.
So countries like the UK and France and Germany, they seem to be focused more on saving businesses by offering loans. For the citizens of those countries, does that mean that their jobs are being saved because those governments will essentially keep the businesses afloat?
Yeah, great question. The essential shock that the coronavirus is generating is actually a shock to businesses that serve customers. To try to slow the growth of the virus, what needs to happen is people need to stop going out. And when people go out, a lot of what they do is they consume. They go to restaurants, they go to movies, they go to sporting events. So the public health necessity to stop the growth of the virus is imposing a large unexpected shock on a lot of businesses. Those businesses are suddenly losing revenue. The restaurants, the hotels, the airlines. So what a lot of other countries are doing, different from the United States at this point at least, is they're recognizing that the essential source of the shock is a drop in demand that businesses are seeing that serve consumers.
Is the calculus for those European countries like, here's some money to offset your losses, and when this is all over, you can just open the doors to your shop or cafe and everybody will go back to work and everything will be fine? Is it that easy?
It's not that simple, but the spirit of that is exactly right. Think about it as socializing the risk economically of bearing the cost to society of trying to stop the coronavirus's growth. So if you think about who's going to share that risk, sovereign governments with their tax and spending authorities are actually well positioned to help offset that unexpected economic blow.
So that makes sense. But I'm wondering also if the idea of European countries focusing on saving businesses as opposed to giving citizens cash, is that because many European countries already have things like government guaranteed healthcare and strong unions, so the citizens have protection from economic uncertainty?
So many countries in Europe and around the world have pretty extensive social safety nets, both to provide income supports and various labor market supports for individuals in transition, and also, as you say, the public provision of healthcare. So if you're thinking about what's new government resources that you're going to put in, many countries start from a pretty different baseline, which is they already have a lot of support for workers in transitions and for their healthcare. So for any given amount that they might be deciding to spend now, they can focus that more on businesses.
And what about the U.S. approach? How does it stack up when you think about what's needed to keep this economy together?
I think we're like a lot of other countries in the sense that it takes a little while to recognize how serious the public health threat is going to be and therefore how extensive the restrictions on economic activity are going to have to be. I think it remains a work in progress to see what Congress and the president do on the fiscal side. That's really where the heart of America's response needs to be right now. Like the Fed, to their credit, like a lot of other central banks, have been very aggressive in recognizing part of what might arise from this economic shock. Again, the heart of the economic shock is a fall in consumption demand by households. So the emergency cuts in interest rates, the new lending facilities, the coordination with other central banks. I think the Fed has been very early in recognizing what it needs to do. A lot of workers are challenged right now because their businesses are challenged right now. And the challenge is, how do you support these businesses in the face of this historic and unexpected shock?
Matthew Slaughter is a global economics professor and the dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Professor Slaughter, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Iran has been hit hard by the coronavirus. The country has more than 18,000 confirmed cases. That's the third highest in the world. And things appear to be getting worse. This week, Iran's health minister said 43 Iranians were becoming infected with the coronavirus every hour. Death tolls will rise, he warned, if Iranians don't start to take this illness seriously. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari with more.
This is becoming a familiar sound in cities across Iran. The authorities are urging people to stay in their homes. But it's too late for a lot of families. The official death toll is 1,000 and rising. The real number could be even higher. Iranian officials failed to warn the public about the outbreak in its early days. And when they eventually did last month, they downplayed its seriousness. This state television host is a former physician. In February, she reassured Iranians that the coronavirus is nothing more than a simple cold. Then, one by one, officials within the government got sick. The health minister, the minister of environment, even an advisor to the supreme leader, all reported they had the coronavirus. So far, at least a dozen Iranian officials are said to have died. But it's healthcare professionals who've been hit hardest. Dr. Mehdi Vareji, a physician in Tehran, posted this video online. He complains about having a high fever and difficulty breathing. He died yesterday.
Hello.
Hello.
Puya Payandemir is another doctor. He's the head of emergency care at Sina Hospital, one of the busiest in Tehran. He says these past few weeks have been some of the most challenging of his professional life.
We were not prepared for a disaster by a virus.
Earthquakes, floods, those things, he says, they were ready for. But a global pandemic, not even close.
And so it took us several days to, for example, put the patients in two lines and separate the infectious patients, symptomatic patients from the asymptomatic patients and something like this.
Payandemir says his staff didn't have enough protective gear at first, and that delay was costly. He says two of his colleagues are now dead from the virus, and that's a lesson for hospitals around the world.
Emergency physicians in every country and emergency staff are at higher risk for getting COVID-19, and they should use personal protection equipment more properly.
Iran has now received some outside help. That's crucial because the country has been under strict U.S. sanctions for years. Medicine and medical equipment are technically exempt, but international companies often shy away from selling goods to Iran because they risk being penalized by the American government. This week, the Trump administration announced new sanctions on Iran. Officials with the World Health Organization visited the country last week. Abdelnasser Abu Bakr was part of the team.
We visited some of the referral hospitals designated for management of coronavirus. We met all the senior officials within the Minister of Health, as well as the local Tehran municipality and the universities.
Abu Bakr says Iran was slow to respond at first, but the government is working hard to get the outbreak under control.
Community leaders need to have harmonized messages to the community, and the community needs to be guided what needs to be done.
He says the government needs to send a clear message to the public in the coming days. Iranians are about to begin celebrating Nowruz, the Persian New Year. Normally, that means lots of shopping, travel, and family visits. All of that could make the outbreak worse. The head of Iran's coronavirus response team went on television yesterday. He pleaded with the public to stay home. This year, he says, Nowruz will be different. Meanwhile, Iranians outside the country are scrambling to change their plans for the new year.
It's a really sad and hard time for the community, both in Iran and in diaspora.
Sahar Rudachi lives in Washington, D.C. She canceled her flight to visit her parents outside Atlanta. She says they'll all be celebrating Nowruz on FaceTime this year. It's not the same, of course, but her mom sent her a message that helped put things in perspective.
About, how I should stay strong and how her own experiences coming here during the revolution.
The 1979 revolution uprooted many Iranian families.
She was able to stay strong through that. So I'm trying really hard to really keep that in mind and just remember that it's going to be okay.
It's going to be okay. That's a reminder we could probably all use right now. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Believe it or not, today is the first day of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. If March 19th feels early, it is. The first day of spring is normally March 20th or the 21st. Today's the first time it's landed on the 19th in 124 years. Spring actually happens when the Earth's axis hits a specific angle, tilted neither toward or away from the sun. That kind of planetary movement doesn't always conform with our human calendars, but early spring, I'll take it. Nice to remember what it brings.
So, in a world of snow, of things that come and go, where what you think you know, you can't be certain of, you must believe in spring and love.
Rigmor Gustafsson of Sweden with her cover of You Must Believe in Spring. Offices across the globe are shut down. What's not stopping, though, is work. That's carrying on remotely, thanks to video chat, email, and instant messenger. Tons of offices around the globe are using a tool known as Slack. Full disclosure, we are too. Our newsroom is practicing social distancing, and most of us are working from home. Stuart Butterfield is Slack's CEO. He describes Slack as a messaging platform with channels.
You take the communication that would have happened in individual inboxes, and you move it to what are called channels. And the channels are kind of widely accessible. You can search what's going on. And it means that everyone knows where to go to ask a question or to give an update.
So do you have any recent numbers on how many more users are on Slack globally since the coronavirus outbreak started?
We have 110,000 customers around the world, and they range from U.S. federal government and enormous companies to, you know, small businesses, florists, offices, dentists, restaurants. We haven't been publishing any revised numbers, but it's been a huge surge both among existing users, and we've also seen a huge surge in new signups.
What countries is it most popular in now? Where is Slack being used that it wasn't before?
U.S. is our biggest country. Japan is a really strong number two and had already been growing really quickly before the outbreak of coronavirus. We've seen a big surge there. Definitely the spike in new interest tracks the countries that are in the headlines today. So we see a lot more signups in Italy, going back a couple of weeks, South Korea, and now a massive spike in the U.S.
Many people, as you know, Stuart, find it hard to disconnect from work emails, messages, and updates on a regular basis. Now it's all happening in your living room or your bedroom or your kitchen. So how do you recommend keeping that work-life balance?
I look back to 2001 or something like that, and I remember an article in the Weekend Journal talking about how BlackBerries are ruining our lives. So I think in every wave of new technology, we've had a little bit of trouble in the early days figuring out how to best take advantage of it without giving up the balance that we had found over time with regular working hours and all of that. When I look at what's happened with our work from home transition, we have employees in a lot of cities where schools are closed. Suddenly, spouses are negotiating for who gets which corner of the kitchen table to do their video while there's two or three kids running around.
The walls come down between work and life. I mean, I just had my wife looking at me last night as I was on my phone. What are you doing? And I was like, I'm working. It was 9 p.m. So it's like, it's going to be a struggle, right?
It's definitely going to be a struggle, and it'll take us some time to kind of negotiate how to draw the boundaries. I've heard a lot of good advice. People say, try to draw some demarcation, have a shower, eat breakfast. If you had a commute, maybe go for a walk around the block a couple times to kind of set off, you know, now I'm in work mode, and then do the opposite at the end of the day to say, now I'm at home and I have other priorities and have to take care of my family and so on.
There are so many predictions right now about how coronavirus is changing everything, like everything. And it's hard to say with any accuracy right now what will happen. But you must be thinking about offsite work once the coronavirus dust has settled. What does your very different future look like in terms of work culture around the globe?
So I think what we'll find is people are, you know, falling into the deep end of the pool here a little bit. It's unclear to me at this point how much of the work from home will persist, although I think we'll definitely see more of that. What I do hope that we see is a change in how people communicate and a larger movement from inboxes, which are really an individual first approach to communication, to team first.
Slack CEO and co-founder Stuart Butterfield, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marco.
During this pandemic, museums around the world are shut down, but arts institutions everywhere are saying, if the people can't come to the art, let the art come to the people. Here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum.
Tell me if you can relate to this. A group of friends are trapped at home. They're trying to avoid getting sick, and they're bored stiff. Just sounds like a day in the life right now, right? Well, it's also the plot of Boccaccio's Decameron, a literary masterpiece from the Middle Ages. It later inspired a Vivaldi opera. In the Decameron, the characters decide to pass the time by telling each other stories. They tell 10 tales in 10 days. The friends fight boredom with culture. The Uffizi Gallery in Florence has taken this lesson to heart. The director of the museum, Eike Schmidt, went on social media to announce the new hashtag Uffizi Decameron.
Anche se i musei hanno dovuto chiudere le loro porte,
He says even though museums have had to close their doors, art and culture don't stop. And so, like in the Decameron, the Uffizi tour guides have been telling one story a day about their favorite works of art in the collection and posting those videos online to keep us entertained at home.
La collezione Contini è una collezione molto varia, opere di diverse tipologie.
Il mito di Arianna è uno dei miti più affascinanti della mitologia greca.
The Uffizi isn't alone. Museums around the world are showing off their most calming works of art on social media under the hashtag MuseumMomentOfZen. Cheryl Victor Levy, the head of communications at the Museum of the City of New York, started it.
When it became very clear that the museum would have to close, I said, how can we try to find a way to inspire and bring a ray of sunshine into what's pretty much a dark moment?
So her team posted a watercolor from 1920 of three people gazing into a turtle tank. And I can't tell you why, but when you look at it, your breath just slows. Cheryl Victor Levy says it's been a pleasure to watch how the hashtag has taken off.
The Japan Museum and museums in Luxembourg, the museums in Nova Scotia, I mean, they're all posting, you know, whether it's contemporary art, whether it's, you know, in interactives.
She says they're all just trying to bring people peace. But if it's not peace you're after and instead want to laugh, I suggest you check out the hashtag MuseumFromHome, where museum enthusiasts are explaining their favorite museum artifact in 60 seconds or less.
Hello, fellow isolationists. I've got 1 minute to tell you all about the Fiji mermaid in a tank top for reasons. So, the Fiji mermaid is actually not just one thing, it's a whole collection of things. Let's start by defining what a mermaid is. Half fish, half human. You find them all over the world in folklore. For example, West Africa, you've got Mami Wata. In ancient Syrian legends, you have the goddess...
I even gave it a try and recorded my own 60-second museum from home.
I want to talk about a bar at the Folie Bergère. It's by Edward Manet. It's at the Courtauld Institute of Art in England, and it's this painting of a barmaid, and she has a... This is really hard.
Now, will seeing a video or a JPEG online replace seeing art in person? Of course not. But desperate times call for desperate measures. And as the director of the Uffizi, Eike Schmidt, says,
Evitiamo ogni contagio, tranne quello della
we have to avoid all contagion, except that of beauty. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The online art Sarah told us about is easy to find. We have links at theworld.org. And now we exit through the gift shop. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.